MSW Media.
You know, what you need to understand about Reconstruction is how short-lived it was.
Yeah.
It's a very short period.
Prevail. Це щотижнева програма про політику.
L'histoire, la sécurité nationale.
Crimine organizzato, dinero sucio.
Глобальну корупцію та боротьбу за демократію.
E ora?
А тепер?
E maintenant?
Con ustedes, su anfitrión?
Грегор Голіаф.
Welcome back to the fight. This time I know our side will win.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show. Manisha Sinha is here. If you like what I'm doing on the podcast, please subscribe, review, download, and share episodes with your friends. The Prevail column on Substack has been going since November of 2019. Lots of stuff in the archives about Leonard Leo, Brett Kavanaugh, Jared Kushner, Putin, Trump, Russia, Ukraine, and much, much more. Every piece at Prevail is free to read and always will be. No paywalls ever. Your generous support keeps it that way. Subscriptions are just $6 a month, $55 a year. Visit gregoliar.substack.com to learn more. Manisha Sinha is the Draper Chair in American History at the University of Connecticut. She's the author of The Slave's Cause, A History of Abolition, which won the Frederick Douglass Book Prize. And she wrote this new book called The Rise and Fall of the Second American Republic, Reconstruction, 1860 to 1920, which blew my mind, as I told her. It blew my mind. It's one of these books that I think is going to be an instant classic. There's a book by Eric Foner, the great historian, F-O-N-E-R, Foner, and called just Reconstruction, which is kind of the, as Manisha says in the interview, kind of the gold standard of that period of time in terms of history books. This one takes that and just expands on it in such interesting ways. Reconstruction is the period after the Civil War when basically the North tried to integrate the South back into the Union. And what happened was it ended too quickly. The Confederates and the rebels didn't really apologize or admit that they did anything wrong or accept the results of the war, which were that all Americans, including Black Americans, had civil rights now and they could vote and stuff like that. This was intolerable to people in the South, in the old Confederacy, and they simply just refused to go along with the program. Reconstruction was meant to make sure that freedmen, the formerly enslaved Americans, would now be able to access their civil rights, which they were granted under the 13th Amendment. It ended in, historically, traditionally, 1877, when Rutherford B. Hayes became president and basically told the troops there to go home, or rather sent the troops to the West to conquer the Indian lands. And that was a weird election. It was the election of 1876, which, if you remember from your American history class, that was the first time that a candidate who lost the popular vote won in the Electoral College. And there was lots of shenanigans and backroom deals, but or maybe there weren't. We don't really know. But the long and the short is that the Republican candidate, Rutherford B. Hayes, remember at that time, Republicans were still the good guys and Democrats were the racist, awful people. Somehow it flipped. The Republican candidate won, but it was like a bad Republican who didn't really care about the whole like integrating the slaves or the freed slaves back into society's thing, and kind of pivoted the Republican Party towards big business to the expense of civil rights of lots of people. And it was after that election that basically the South started to impose these horrible Jim Crow laws and figure out ways around the 13th Amendment to be able to basically exercise their racism and make sure that the South stayed, you know, this white supremacist kind of place, which it did until basically the 1960s, legally. So when Manisha says the Second American Republic, that's what she's talking about, that period of time where everybody could vote, you know, that where black male Americans could vote. And she ends it in 1920, as I asked her, because that was when women got the right to vote. And that was the last, as she calls it, the last Reconstruction Amendment, because it expanded the franchise to other people. So anyway, this book doesn't end in 1877. It goes on through 1900, basically, because all this stuff happens after 1877, which is really important and pivotal in understanding American history and where we are now. You know, I remember being in high school and, you know, we learned a little bit about the Civil War. And then I think we spent like maybe 20 minutes talking about that 1876 election that I just alluded to. And then we pretty much went to World War One. I think maybe there was a day or two where we talked about McKinley assassination and Teddy Roosevelt or whatever. But it was mostly just a big leap between wars. And I think that's often how history is taught, as, OK, this is a war and here's another war. And sometimes it's the stuff in between the wars that's important. In the Reconstruction period, as defined here by Manisha, it basically sets the stage for everything that follows, because you have all these Jim Crow laws. You have all of this racism now embedded into society and the local laws and the state laws and all this stuff that comes out of this period of time. You have incredible, incredible voter suppression, which isn't supposed to happen anymore after the 13th Amendment, after the Civil War, and yet does and continues. And into the 1890s, when most black people in the South just didn't vote at all, just couldn't vote for a variety of what she calls chicanery. You know, and these are things that happen. That was also the period of time when the United States basically conquered the rest of the continent. Manifest destiny is the term that was thrown around when I was learning about history. And the troops basically went from the South of the United States, where they had been imposing martial law to get ex-Confederates to be less racist, basically, and stop killing and terrorizing black people, and moved all of the troops to the West to conquer the Indian lands, which they did. So all of this stuff is related. It's related to the labor movement in the North, which also starts to come into its own at this time. It's related to all this big business, which especially under McKinley reaches a kind of apogee, where the government's just like, we're going to let the businessmen do whatever they want. There's no laws protecting anybody or anything, basically. There's no cap on anything that these people want to do. That was the period of time this happened. And finally, it was a period of American empire, which wasn't something that the United States traditionally had been that interested in. It was during this brief period of time, which continued under Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, where the United States went and, you know, after especially the Spanish-American War in 1898, just like took stuff, you know, the Philippines, Guam, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, and added territory to its portfolio, which we don't tend to think about here that much. It's just sort of a thing that we think, oh, Puerto Rico, you know, it's not a state, it's a protectorate or whatever. You know, that's where it came from. That's why that situation is set up. So, and it's weird that we have this functionally a state that isn't a state, that can't vote, that has no representation in our government, and should, frankly. So maybe if Puerto Rico had, you know, representatives in the House and two senators, Trump would have done something more than just throwing paper towels at people after the hurricane, right? So all of this stuff comes together, and it's all intertwined, and there's lots of political dealings, and throughout, there are great people, abolitionists and, you know, leaders in the African-American community and so on, who are pushing and pushing and pushing for equal rights, for universal suffrage, for all this good stuff. And then there are the forces of evil combating that. And Manisha does such a wonderful job in this book explaining all of this in its complexity. And it's just a wonderful book. I can't recommend it highly enough. I mean, if you really want to understand not just what happens historically in the United States, what's happening now in the United States, you have to understand that period of time, which I think they don't really teach about in high school history class. They just don't, because it's too complicated. And, you know, we were assholes at that time. We were horrible. And I think people are reluctant to teach about a period when we were just openly racist, openly genocidal, to the point where what we did with the Native Americans in this country was so awful that Hitler modeled his own project on it. It's that level of awful. And that's what we were up to. So I should also add, this isn't one of those books where she's just saying, oh, America bad, America bad. It's not like that at all. It's very complicated. There's plenty of heroes in the book. And, you know, it's just a really good history book. And I learned a lot from it. Yeah, I'm still thinking about it. I'm actually going through and reading it again so that I can miss anything. I want to really nail my understanding of the period. So I highly, highly, highly encourage you to buy and read this book and support her work. I think this book's going to be around for a long time. Again, it's called The Rise and Fall of the Second American Republic. It came out, I think, last week. It's by Manisha Sinha. I've got nothing else up front, really. I hope everybody enjoyed the Easter weekend. I did. I had a nice time. I needed to take the week off, which I think I forgot to mention last time, so apologies about that. But I needed to take the week off because I was doing college visits with my kids, you know, so which went well because college is on the horizon. And this morning, it is snowing here in upstate New York. Not a lot of snow, but a little bit of snow. We've got snow in April. We've got the eclipse coming. We've got Truth Social on the stock market. I don't know, man. Things are going crazy. Leonard Leo says we're all barbarians. And maybe he's right. Maybe we all are. Anyway, I don't want to. I've already talked way too long. And I want to get to Manisha because it's a great interview and a great book. So without further ado, without more of my prattle, we'll be right back with Manisha Sinha.
Are you fixing to overthrow the government? Do you find the suite of applications like WhatsApp too clunky for your purposes? Hi, I'm Lauren Boebert, here to tell you about a new app that lets you coordinate all your seditious activities right from your burner phone. With Whovite, you can send out invites, issue real-time orders, broadcast the movements of the House Speaker, and blame the whole thing on Black Lives Matter! Here's Alex Jones of InfoWars.
On January 6th, our attempt to stop the steal failed, mostly because of poor coordination. If we had Kuvite, Donald Trump would still be in the White House where he belongs, and I would not have to plead the fifth and stop talking.
Kuvite, that's Coupvite. Use promo code TREASON. That's T for Trump and then Reason to get 10% off your first purchase. Kuvite with Kuvite. Now back to the show.
Manisha Sinha, welcome to Prevail.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. I'm very excited to talk to you because you've written this book called The Rise and Fall of the Second American Republic, Reconstruction 1860 to 1920, which honestly, I read it and my mind is blown a little bit. I think this is like a this is like an instant classic kind of book. I really believe it because, you know, I've seen you on Twitter for a while now, and I was like, oh, she's writing this book about Reconstruction. That should be interesting. I want to learn more about Reconstruction. And so I wanted to read the book regardless, but it really just blew my mind. It's fantastic. You know, I'm sort of blown away by it. How long did it take you to write this thing?
Well, it did take me around, I would say, maybe 7-8 years. I started researching it even before my second book was published. So maybe close to a decade, but really seriously researching and writing it in 7 to 8 years. But Greg, thank you so much for your kind words. I have to tell you, yours is the first reaction that I have gotten.
Really?
To this. It is because, well, of course, the blurbs, you know, the people who read it prior to publication, but the pub date is actually this Tuesday, March 26th. So yours is the first sort of public reaction to the book. So I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean it. I think everybody should read it. First of all, the book itself is, it's like beautiful. It's really well done. It's like the, I don't know who designed it, but, you know, the inside, even the paper is really nice. You have all these cool pictures of newspaper cartoons and stuff like that from the era and quotes and all this stuff. So as a physical artifact, it's good and it's worth it because like I said, and I really mean it, this is a, you know, really blew my mind in a lot of ways. So I'm eager to talk about it. And sort of the premise of it is that, you know, that put it this way, when I learned about Reconstruction, and I think I did in high school, we basically went from the Civil War is over, Lincoln freed the slaves, to, hey, it's World War One now. And I think maybe we spent like an hour maybe talking about the labor movement, which seemed like kind of maybe something we should know more about. But I feel like that period of time, and I've always felt this in my brain, that that period of time between the Civil War and, you know, basically the First World War is super important in the evolution of the country. So you have shown why that is. And I think the reason why we don't learn about it is because it was just awful. Like so many bad things happened during this time. So, but before we get to that, tell us what you've written. Two other books. One of them is Slaves' Cause, A History of Abolition, and one called The Counter-Revolution of Slavery. So what prompted you to start writing this book now? Otherwise, now is 8 years ago. But yeah, what was your impetus?
Well, yes. Firstly, let me thank you again for the kind words about the production of the book. I'm afraid I can't take credit for that. That is all the people at LibWrite and Norton. They just did a fantastic job with a lot of back and forth, and I made sure that they made me work hard to get all those illustrations. So yeah, they get the credit. But in terms of what led me to this book, you know, I see myself as a historian of the long 19th century. And my first book was really sort of a coming of the Civil War book. And I really wanted to understand pro-slavery ideology and the sort of constitutional theory of states' rights, really an absolute notion of state sovereignty, which has suddenly become popular again, went to, you know, people who were arguing for secession. So I looked at that. The second book was on abolition. And with that, I went back a little bit to the late 18th century, looking at the genesis of the movement from the Revolution to the Civil War. I also wanted to write a book about people I liked, you know. I'm a slaveholder. I said, let's spend some time with the good guys, with the abolitionists. This book was not something that I had planned to write, interestingly enough. I was, you know, my mentor, Eric Foda, had written the book on Reconstruction. And even though I teach it a lot, and in a way, the book is shaped by my students' questions, I didn't plan on writing a book on Reconstruction. I did want to know what happened to the abolitionist project after the Civil War. And many of the Reconstruction laws and amendments have their roots in abolitionist ideas about Black citizenship, Black political equality, equality before the law, and all that fed into those amendments. So I said, why not look at the two most admirable radicals, Charles Sumner and Thaddeus Stevens, who really had the vision for Reconstruction. They may not have written all the laws and the amendments, but it was their vision coming out of abolition that influenced Reconstruction and the growth of interracial democracy during Reconstruction. And that's what I wanted to do, just write a dual biography. The person who gets credit for making me write a new book on Reconstruction, besides my mentor, Eric Foda, whose work was always at the back of my head, was my editor, Dan Gerstle. You know, he first commissioned the book for Basic, and then when he moved to LibWrite, I simply followed him there. He saw something in the proposal. He said, I think this could be a new book on Reconstruction and a new look at this very pivotal moment in American history. And, you know, as you rightly noted, most American history textbooks gloss over this period because it isn't a very nice period in the history of American democracy. I mean, this is a period when American democracy is overthrown in the South, where newly freed enslaved people are back in, not in slavery, but in conditions that are barely, you know, above the status of slavery. So it's not a very happy period. And I think Americans tend not to think about moments in their history when democracy was systematically overthrown and emasculated in this country. And I think given the situation we are in today, it's probably a good idea to study this period so that we don't repeat the mistakes of the past.
Yeah, you lucked out with the timing, I have to say. It's great that democracy is on the ropes here. So
I would rather that it would not be, you know. Studying books is not the what, you know. Everyone tells me that. They said, you timed this perfectly. But, you know, when I started thinking about this project when I finished my abolition book. I actually finished it in 2013, even though it came out eventually in 2016. I was already thinking about this project. And I had no idea at that point. I mean, this was Obama's second term. I had no idea that, Trump would win the Electoral College. I had no idea that he would pose such a great threat to American democracy and literally hijack one of the parties in a two-party system, which is very dangerous.
Yeah. So one of the things that I think is interesting about, there's a lot of things that are interesting about this, that just for people listening, what you've done is taken Reconstruction, which is usually kind of a very localized kind of thing. That's usually how it's presented, is this is what's happening in the South and that's it. And it doesn't connect necessarily with things in the North, certainly with things in the West, with the conquest of the native lands and with stuff that's happening in the rest of the world. So you integrate all of those things into the narrative, which I think is wonderful and a really, really interesting way to look at it. And then you create this idea of the Second American Republic, and you give it dates from 1860 to 1920. So you expand the time frame of what is usually considered Reconstruction. So that's the first question, is talk about that a little bit. Where did you come up with the Second American Republic? And why did you pick that? I mean, 1860 is pretty obvious, but why did you pick 1920 as the end date? What was your thinking about all of that?
That's a great question. You know, when I started writing this book, I did not mean it to replace Eric Foner's magnum opus on Reconstruction, because I think that book is still probably the best book, the sort of gold standard in the history of Reconstruction. But I did intend it as a sequel to his book, because he ends his book in 1877, and a lot of things are happening after 1877, right up to 1900. And even though I put 1920 as the sort of end date, because I wanted to include the 19th Amendment, because I thought it's that gave women the right to vote, because I thought that the struggle for the 19th Amendment really begins during Reconstruction, and that we had to look at those roots. And also because it is really the last Reconstruction Amendment. It's modeled after the 15th Amendment that gave Black men the right to vote in 1870. And so the book really ends in 1900, and I would give that parameter for the Second American Republic. And the reason why I think that's important is because even though the sort of last Reconstruction governments are overthrown, by 1877, which is where most people conventionally end Reconstruction, a lot happens in the period after 1877. There are new interracial coalitions in some of the Upper South states, like North Carolina and Virginia, between populists and Republicans, that challenge the sort of racist, solid South Democratic conservative rule at that point. It also misses out the fact that a lot of the formal disfranchisement of Black people takes place in the 1890s, beginning with the Mississippi Constitution of 1890, then followed by all the Southern states. The rise of Jim Crow, for instance, Plessy versus Ferguson, 1896. Wounded Knee, 1890, which is like the sort of end point to the demise of indigenous sovereignty in the West. Or if you look at the tremendous strife over conditions of the working class, the rise of industrial capitalism, all those massive labor confrontations, beginning with the railroad strike of 1877, goes right up to the 1890s. You know, there's Homestead, there's Pullman, and then the rise of formal American empire and overseas empire, right? I thought it was really important to understand all that. Again, this comes from a lot of questions my students had. They're like, how do we go from Reconstruction to really the Jim Crow South, the sort of brutal pacification of the Philippines and its colonization, the annexation of all these territories and the constant interventions in Central and Latin America? All this really gets jump-started at this point. And to understand modern American history and society and politics, I thought, hey, we have to look at how the fall of Reconstruction impacted not just Black people very adversely, but all these disparate groups And I would include in that, of course, the exclusion acts and racially restrictive immigration laws that begin with the Chinese Exclusion Act, but then continue right up to 1924. It's the law that Donald Trump evoked when he said, we should have only Norwegians coming into this country because it discriminated against Southern and Eastern Europeans and certainly against the rest of the world. So to understand all that, you know, where do all these ideas come from? Unreconstructed notions of what constitutes an American citizen or the sort of nativism and misogyny that we are seeing today. You could go right back to this period and sort of look at the historical roots of many of those ideas.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. The end date, you said 1900. I would say as soon as McKinley dies, that's when it ends. I feel like that's the, when people say Trump wants to, you know, send the world back to the whatever, I say it's, he wants to, you know, go back to McKinley. That's the period that he wants, the darkest sort of thing. But let's start, I want to start closer to the beginning of this period and just ask a couple of questions. Because I certainly during the insurrection and after all of that, I thought a lot about Booth killing Lincoln and how I wrote a lot of times that the insurrection is the worst thing that happened or the greatest threat to the country, the Republic since that happened. And it's interesting to read about it in your book. And I've read a lot about that before. I've been to Ford's Theater and all that stuff. And it's kind of, you know, creepy almost to be in that space. But and then after that, Lincoln dies. So he, right at the beginning of the second term, Johnson takes over. He's just a train wreck, just awful, awful. And all of the Reconstruction, the momentum for it is kind of curtailed. So in a sense, Booth got what he wanted, which really makes me mad, right? So talk about why Booth did what he did, because that was interesting to me, and what the biggest impacts of Lincoln dying when he did were.
Yeah, that's a, you know, great question also, because, you know, I'm a political historian, and for a long time, I think we need to understand politics, both as presidential politics and also as grassroots politics and the ways they interact. I'm not one of those either-or people who say, let's just do the high politics, or the others who say, let's just look at the grassroots. I mean, what's most interesting about history is the complexity and the nuances and how all these things influence each other. And I really liked what you had to say about McKinley, because with McKinley, you can really see how the Republican Party goes from being the party of Lincoln and anti-slavery to the party of empire and big business. So with Johnson, you know, this, you know, people look at Booth's assassination of Lincoln and they say, oh, just a random assassin, like lone assassin. And actually, it was a political assassination very much. And it did influence the politics of that period enormously. And we need to look at it that way. And that is why I see Lincoln as actually our first Reconstruction president. He's normally not seen in that manner because he's dead in 1865. But if you look at many of the initiatives he took or the many initiatives that got taken under his administration, whether it's the establishment of the Freedmen's Bureau, I think that's a really important moment in the history of Reconstruction, the establishment of a federal agency that would oversee the transition from slavery to freedom, and the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery, which really unleashes progressive constitutionalism. So I thought that it was important to look at John Wilkes Booth as not the lone assassin, but as really representative of this sort of unreconstructed, diehard Confederate view of how the post-war South should look. That they would resist to an extreme any attempt to enforce Black civic and political equality. And if you look at John Wilkes Booth, I mean, he comes from a state that did not even secede from the Union. It was a slave state, border state that stayed in the Union, Maryland. But he was a Confederate sympathizer, very pro-slavery and racist. He had witnessed the hanging of John Brown delightfully. And he decides to kill Lincoln, not because of emancipation. He decides to kill Lincoln because Lincoln becomes the first American president, actually, to endorse Black political citizenship.
Yeah.
One of his last speeches, he says, you know, I think Black men, especially those who fought in the Union Army, who are educated, who are worthy, should get the right to vote. And for Booth, that was it. This specter of an interracial democracy where African Americans would be seen as fellow citizens rather than enslaved was too much for him to stomach. And he shot Lincoln precisely for that reason. There was a sort of Confederate plot to sort of assassinate sort of leadership of the Union. There were attacks on Seward that night. There was an attack on Andrew Johnson, who was the vice president as well. And there was an attempt also to kill Grant, but he was not around. And so this was a systematic Confederate. We don't know, you know, I think Booth probably acted on his own, but clearly there were ideas afoot, right? It was in the ecosystem. And when Lincoln dies, Confederates celebrate. They actually celebrate his death. They see it as a parting shot of the Confederacy. So I think we really need to bring out those political valences and not just see Booth, this sort of lone assassin, just killing Lincoln and therefore not having an effect. And it did have an enormous effect in, you know, giving us one of the worst presidents in U.S. history, Andrew Johnson. I wrote a couple of articles comparing Andrew Johnson to Trump when Trump was president. And a lot of Trumpists didn't like that too much. It was a straightforward historical comparison. I didn't, you know, say anything against Trump. I was just showing how he was a lot like Johnson. And, you know, I got a death threat from a Trumpist.
Oh, my goodness. How was he? That's terrible.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, it just shows us that this kind of this system. And then Mike Pence wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal responding to mine, defending Andrew Johnson.
Oh, my God.
And saying that his impeachment was, or his attempted impeachment was not constitutional. I wonder what Mike Pence felt like on January 6th, 2021 about that.
I don't think he had any agency. I think he just did what he was told all the time, Pence. So what was your argument there? How is Trump like Johnson, or Johnson like Trump? What are the main points that you made in that piece?
So the main points I made was that Johnson, like Trump, was coddling and giving encouragement to the enemies of the Republic, right? He said his own party at that time, he was a former Democrat, but he was part of the Union coalition, which was predominantly the Republican Party, when he became vice president. And he said that these people are traitors and that, you know, he was pardoning Confederates wholesale. And I was comparing the way in which Trump saw NATO as a problem, but Putin as the sort of great leader, precisely the way Johnson encouraged the Confederates. And of course, the racism was a commonality, the sheer racism, the inability to even think of the United States as an interracial republic. And the fact that Trump defended Confederate monuments as history, as if monuments are history, rather than, you know, particular commemorations. I would hope most Americans know that they can get history in books and not by looking at a statue. So there were a lot of things that I compared Trump and Johnson with. The New York Times article I did, one for CNN, which turned out to be the most downloaded article in CNN, which was a surprise because it's usually their news article and not their opinion pieces. And that's when I got this infamous death threat, and it scared me, and I didn't want to jeopardize my family or my colleagues. And I thought maybe I should just shut up now and not talk about it. And my husband, who's German, said, absolutely not. He says, that's exactly what the Nazis did. They would terrify people into silence, and we can't let that happen. And he's the one who said, no, you should continue writing. I gave up op-eds for some time, though, and I concentrated on writing this book.
Well, I'm glad you concentrated on writing the book, and I'm glad that the threat, you know, didn't go through. That it is scary, and your husband's right. I mean, that is the point, is to silence you. As in your book, you write about the Ku Klux Klan having the same effect on people writing pieces, you know, in the South during that time. One takeaway that I got early on in the book, and I think you talked about this on Dahlia Lithwick's podcast when you were on there a couple weeks ago, is this idea of, you know, showing mercy to the Confederates when they did not acknowledge that what they did was wrong, and that they showed no remorse, and that that kind of thing just basically meant there were no consequences for what they did. And I agree with that. I think that, you know, I think we're still, in a sense, paying that off, you know, paying that back for not properly punishing these traitors. So talk a little bit about that, because I think that's an interesting idea, and it's certainly parallel to now and relevant, unfortunately, to what's going on now with J6. And now, you know, if Trump gets back in, he's going to pardon all these people, and it's going to be a nightmare. So,
yes, hopefully history doesn't repeat in that manner. You know, it all sounds very nice, right? Extending mercy, sectional reconciliation after a horrific war. And, you know, it would have been nice if Confederates had accepted the results of the war, which was that they had lost and that emancipation was a reality. But they refused to accept the results of the war. Instead, they waged a campaign of racist domestic terrorism, not just against Black people, but also against Northern whites and those Southern whites who joined the Republican Party and the Reconstruction government. So this was political terrorism that targeted specifically African Americans, but also all their political opponents. And so it was not as if they were in a mood to be reconciled with. They wanted to restore status quo antebellum. And they were going to try and to do it by hook or by crook. And you can see this, you know, they waged this relentless war against the Reconstruction governments. And that's why I think what happened in terms of first Johnson's mass pardoning of ex-Confederates, but even later on with the 1872 amnesty law, which allowed former Confederates to again run for office from the South. And here they were cowing Black voters with tremendous political violence. And these ex-Confederates are able to, after having, you know, held federal office, being negligent to their oath of office to the U.S. Constitution, after being regular traitors and taking up arms against the American Republic, they're back in Congress after the fall of Reconstruction. You know, somebody like Alexander Stevens, who was the vice president of the Confederacy, is strutting about in the Senate soon after Reconstruction. And that was the real tragedy, because these people thought that they had won the peace, which they had, in fact.
Yeah.
They had lost the war, but they won the peace. And pardoning them was the worst thing. It was what is more akin to what we would call the politics of appeasement when it came to Hitler and the fascists. And we know that those people can never be appeased. You give them an inch, they will keep taking a yard and more. And, you know, you would think that when once these ex-Confederates and, you know, these sort of dyed-in-the-wool racist demagogues like Ben Tillman in South Carolina, James Waterman from Mississippi, I mean, these were really, you know, they had participated in lynchings, and they were really pretty awful. And if you read their speeches, your blood runs dry, much like when you read the speeches of fascists and Nazis. And these people were not appeased by having political power. They unleashed a reign of terror against African Americans. Even though Reconstruction was overthrown, Black people are disfranchised. They say, so even when you have rendered a people powerless virtually, you still have an enormous uptick in lynchings, an enormous uptick in racial massacres in the South. And the contagion is not, you know, confined to the South. By the First World War, it spreads North and West. It's a national shame. So, yes, and the founding of the Second Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s on a racist and nativist agenda is the sort of end point of that. And I just think that, you know, you can't compromise with certain things. Political compromise sounds good in theory, and it is good, but you don't compromise with slavery. You don't compromise with Nazis, and you don't compromise with Jim Crow segregationist lynchers. You know, you try and establish the rule of law and the principles of democratic governance and representative government, which are in our Constitution. So I really feel that democracy in the United States was completely overthrown in that period. And that the United States at that time was not just a city on a hill, but it's, you know, this sort of underside could act as a source of inspiration to fascists all over the world, and which it did.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm not one of those who thinks U.S. history is all wonderful and, you know, linear progress of democracy, those mythic ideas. But I'm also not one of those who thinks it's all about racism and it's all about oppression. I do think, as I put it in the introduction of the book, that there has always been contestation and there have always been two sides on this, even in the most dismal days of the Republic. So even with Jim Crow, you had the birth of new civil rights organizations called, and you end up with the civil rights movement. The roots of that movement come up during this period too. So that's what I wanted to capture in this book, that contestation between, you know, forces of reaction and authoritarianism and those who tried to uphold democracy in this country as much as possible. Because American citizens could today take a, you know, we could learn a bit from that contest during this period.
Yeah, absolutely. And you do a great job of it, because your book is, there are moments when I almost want to cry because the stuff is so horrible. And there's also moments when I feel good and it makes me almost want to cry because somebody's doing something wonderful. And it really is, you know, the extremes of how these people are. You know, it's not that long ago, really, which is also something to hard to wrap your head around. You mentioned the KKK. I want to get back to that, but we have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Benicia Sinha.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp Therapy Online. For 10% off your first month, go to betterhelp.com/Greg. What's the first thing you'd do if you had an extra hour in your day? I always wish I had more time. I've got so many things to do and not enough time to do them. Probably I would sleep. It would be great to have like one more hour of sleep. I would love to spend an hour concentrated on reading books. That would be great. You know, there's lots of things to do. We could just binge another episode of The Bear or whatever. You know, a lot of us spend our lives wishing we had more time. But like, time for what? If time was unlimited, how would you use it? The best way to squeeze that special thing into your schedule is to know what's important to you and make that thing a priority. And sometimes, I mean, it seems simple, right? Like, what's important to you? Well, you should know, but sometimes it's hard to know. You know, it's hard to really, there's so many responsibilities that we have in modern life that it can be hard to really know and understand what's important and what we want. You know, what do we really want? What do you really want? Therapy can help you find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. You know, it's a real thing. I've always had problems of what I want really. You know, if you could do anything, anywhere, at any time, what would you be doing? I don't know. I think I would be doing this right now. I'd be talking to you guys on my podcast. That's what I would be doing. Therapy can help you find what matters to you so you could do more of it. You know, therapy is helpful for learning positive coping skills, how to set boundaries. It empowers you to be the best version of yourself. You know, it isn't just for those who have experienced major trauma. That's a myth. Anybody can benefit from therapy. Anybody. Anybody at all. There's not a human on earth that could not benefit from therapy. I am a big believer in it. And I think BetterHelp is a great way to access therapy. You know, it's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient and flexible and suited to your schedule. And what I really like about it is that it's quick. You know, relatively speaking, it's you find a therapist very quickly, because I find that people that are taking the step to go to therapy, usually there's a reason why, and they want to get to the therapist as soon as possible so they can start accessing the benefits. And BetterHelp, you know, hooks you up pretty quickly. So you just fill out a brief questionnaire, you get matched with a licensed therapist, you switch therapists at any time, no additional charge. So learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Greg today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Greg. Start living a better life today.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me in a courtroom how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing in the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, "If I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized."
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
Okay, we're back with Manisha Sinha. Before the break, we're talking about a lot of things, but you mentioned the second, the revival of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s. One thing I really learned a lot from your book is the first iteration of the KKK. I didn't know a lot about it. I knew that it was there and you just sort of hear about it, but it really was basically just a large scale domestic terror organization, and reading all of the horrible things that they did, not just to Black people, but to anybody that was helping Black people at all, almost indiscriminately. Political violence. There was many more assassinations than I ever remember hearing about. And the brutality of how people were treated is very reminiscent of like what Hamas did in Israel on October, and ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and these just sort of, straight up terror organizations. I didn't realize the extent of the violence and the horrors there. And it really is, it was just a horror show. And I always sort of wonder idly, like, why in a Black majority state like Mississippi is it controlled by these racists, these white racists? And the answer is because of the violence and the threat and the oppression and the fear, the very well justified fear of retaliation, as well as the laws that make it so, by the 1890s, there's no Black people are voting at all practically in these states. So. Those were very hard chapters to read, but I think they're important to kind of, talk about, because this is a part of American history. I think, certainly I didn't know that much about it. So talk a little bit about that and what the role is of the KKK, the first iteration.
Yes. So the first KKK that was founded in 1866 is really an organization of mostly former Confederate officers and soldiers. And these men were waging what you could say low-grade guerrilla warfare, or as you put it aptly, they were a terrorist group. They were operating outside the bounds of law, and they were attacking, politicians, Black people who dared to vote or stand for office. They assassinated a member of the House of Representatives. I don't think many Americans realize how many political assassinations of state local officials took place. And in a way, I wanted to retell those stories of barbarity in detail. As Robert Elliott, the Black congressman, Reconstruction congressman from South Carolina put it, pray tell me, who is the barbarian here? Because they always said that Black people were quote, savage and not fit to hold office or vote or be citizens. But the way the white South acted, it made white Southerners who were on the right side also horrified that, you know, somebody like Amos Ackerman of Georgia, who was the attorney general under Grant, who's originally from New Hampshire, maybe not totally Southern, but he was in Georgia and he had, you know, been part of the Confederacy. He was horrified. He says, you know, what's so sad is to see people descend to that level of cruelty and barbarity. And I wanted to sort of retell those stories. Now, I'm not the only one who's done this. There are many historians of Reconstruction, especially of political and racist violence during this period, who've done this before me. Some really good books have been written on this, most recently by Kidada Williams. She has written two excellent books on the history of racist violence and terror and the impact it can have on victims and the way people resisted those. But, you know, one of the most important documents of Reconstruction era is the Joint Committee that was set up by Congress to investigate these acts of terror. And this is when you have the passage of the Enforcement Acts, the Ku Klux Klan Act in particular, that Grant took to put down the Ku Klux Klan. What happens, of course, is that the Ku Klux Klan is put down, but you have other racist terror groups springing up. You know, the White League, the Knights of the White Camellia, the White Liners, the Red Shirts, which reminded me, you know, of the Brown Shirts, because they were, again, doing pretty much what the Brown Shirts would do in Nazi Germany. So, or the Black Shirts of Mussolini in Italy. So these, they were really, you know, going out, intimidating people, and through wholesale violence, overthrowing Reconstruction governments. They do this in Mississippi. It's the Mississippi Plan of 1875. And eventually in South Carolina, Louisiana, the same thing happens. Or if you look right up to 1898, and that's why I think it's important to go up to the 1890s, the Wilmington Massacre in North Carolina, where interracial city government is overthrown by racist terror, by people inspired by the Red Shirts of South Carolina from an earlier time in the 1870s. So it was really important for me to tell this story of brutality, that people realize that this is not a question of, quote, being politically correct or woke. American historians have been detailing this for quite some time. But it seems as if it hasn't sunk in the popular sphere. So I spent a lot of time in the chapters on the Freedmen's Bureau, where you have tremendous records of federal agents literally recording acts of terrorism against individual Black people, whether it's economic intimidation or political intimidation. And that legacy lives on in the South. It lives on. I mean, the Voting Rights Act, unfortunately, of the Civil Rights Movement has been emasculated by the Supreme Court in Shelby versus Holder in 2013. But, you know, the South is still doing the same thing. Maybe not that level of violence, but the kinds of legal and political chicanery involved in voter suppression today is really invented during Reconstruction. And I wanted people to be aware of that. So the first of the half of the book spends a lot of time on Reconstruction in the South and the way it is violently contested, even for that short period when Reconstruction governments and interracial governments, I mean, the only time that the South really has democratic government from the Revolution to the Civil Rights Movement is that short period of Reconstruction. And I wanted to detail the ways in which these people systematically targeted these Reconstruction state governments and systematically targeted African Americans so that they could have them back laboring in Southern plantations, producing cash crops, predominantly cotton, for the world market.
Well, you do a great job of laying that all out, even though, like I said, it's hard to read because it's just so awful. It's just awful and embarrassing as an American. It's just like embarrassing that we haven't even dealt with this. You talked about the stuff, the little tricks that they're doing now to suppress voting rights. But there was lots of things also that they did at that time, like they would try to, if there was a governor, the governor of Arkansas, they try, who was, you know, pro, he was a Republican, which at that time was a good thing. So they would try to impeach him for just no reason, you know, to make up something and to get him out of there so they could keep on doing this. And it succeeded in North Carolina when they impeached William Holden, who's not, I suppose, the movie actor Bill Holden, but a different guy. And, you know, I didn't know that all that stuff was going on. That was successful. They impeached him for absolutely no reason. It was like Jim Comer, you know, and Jim Jordan were back in time, except that this time, you know, they were successful. But then the flip side is that, you know, Grant does establish the Department of Justice specifically to fight these domestic terror organizations in the South, which is interesting. And I knew that on a very, you know, surface level, but I see now why he did it and why it was necessary. And I guess the second term with the economics of it made it so that there just wasn't enough appetite to continue, and it just sort of petered out. I want to talk about the election of 1876, because I think that's important. That's usually, I think that's when Reconstruction ends formally in most textbooks after Hayes takes over. But that was the first time that the winner of the popular vote lost in the Electoral College, and there was this big, you know, sort of problem about it and backdoor deals that we still don't really know what happened and why, but it seemed pretty clear that they were giving Hayes the job with the understanding that he would just shut all the Reconstruction stuff down, even though Rutherford Hayes was nominally a Republican and, you know, people wanted him there because they thought he would continue the thing. So that really everybody gets screwed over by that. So we did learn about that in school, but mostly just because of the Electoral College thing. But talk a little bit about that, because I think it's interesting, the, you know, all of it, even the fact that Tilden won the most popular votes is mostly just because the people that, you know, that would vote for the other guy were suppressed so violently.
Yes, absolutely. And you're right. You know, that's the way Reconstruction is still taught. You know, it's the so-called Compromise of 1877. You know, Hayes wins the Electoral College. The states with disputed electoral votes were Louisiana, Florida, and South Carolina. You know, previously historians had like some conspiracy theories, you know, that maybe there were railroad interests involved in this corrupt bargain, that this compromise. And now historians say that that's not entirely true. We don't know whether there was even a formal compromise as such, but we do know the results. And the results is that Hayes, interestingly enough, gets all the Electoral College votes of Louisiana, Florida, and South Carolina to win the Electoral College. But interestingly, at the state level, the Republicans lose, right? At the state level, Democratic administrations, which at that time were the bad guys. Yes, you know, everything we know about the two political parties, just flipped them for the 19th century. They win power in Florida, Louisiana, and South Carolina. And all Hayes does is tell federal troops to stand down and go back to their barracks. It's an end of federal commitment to maintaining the rule of law in the South, to maintaining democratic governance in the South. And, you know, Hayes' cabinet is full of these so-called liberal Republicans, a breakaway group during Grant's second re-election. They were, you know, classical laissez-faire liberals, right? They, what we call political conservatives today, they were against big government. They didn't want government regulation of the economy. They were against Reconstruction. And these are the guys who come to dominate Hayes' administration. Carl Schurz is his Secretary of State. You know, liberal Republicans don't exist as a separate group. They do join up with Democrats against Grant in the 1872 elections. But in the second administration of Grant, with the, you know, financial crisis, the collapse, the panic of 1873, but also corruption scandals that Grant has to face in his, he not himself personally, but many, many members of his administration, all that leads to the fall of a formal commitment by the federal government to upholding these Reconstruction governments. So whether there was a formal compromise of 1877 or not, I'll let other historians keep disputing that. I do know what the results were. And the results were that Hayes is in power and that Democrats take over the last states in the South, which they have systematically started doing already in 1870. So, you know, what you need to understand about Reconstruction is how short-lived it was.
Yeah.
It's a very short period. It's not even 1865 to 1877 because many Southern states have already been restored. I don't like to use the term redeemed with all its kind of fundamentalist religious overtones that many white Southerners used at that time. They're restored to sort of elite, undemocratic rule. Certainly African Americans have been systematically and violently put out of the body politic. So, you know, that is an important landmark in the starting of the completely unwinding of Reconstruction. Because then after 1877, there are still places at state and local levels where you have Black office holders, where you have Black voting, especially in majority Black areas like Lowcountry, South Carolina. You know, African Americans retain power. They continue. It's really not until the 1890s with that complete uptick in racial violence and the systematic legal disfranchisement greenlighted by a very reactionary Supreme Court, sounds familiar, that Reconstruction is completely undone. So I wanted to tell that story too, because it seemed too abrupt to me to just say, okay, 1877, there's the so-called compromise and the government's, because a lot more happens in terms of overthrowing the Second American Republic and its legal and constitutional achievements in this sort of latter half of the 19th century. So yes, it's an important marker. You see the chapter Counter-Revolution of 1876, mm-hmm. by which I'm referring to the presidential elections of 1876. And I really like what you said there, Greg. The conventional history books will always tell you, oh, Rutherford B. Hayes won the Electoral College, but he didn't win the popular vote. Samuel Tilden, the Democratic candidate, did. But we don't know what the popular vote was, because most African Americans in the South had been violently excluded from the polls. So to say that Tilden won the popular vote is to completely turn a blind eye to the suppression of the vote of former slaves and Black people in the South.
Yeah, yeah. It's just something I hadn't occurred to me before. So I think it was interesting to read the best history books, I think, are the ones that really show all the shades of gray in various things. Like, you know, like you mentioned the long 19th century, like the Hobsbawm books are just like, you know, there's so much going on that he's throwing at you that, you know, it's almost like this tapestry that's woven together. And there's very seldom one thing that goes in this direction. So, you know, you did a good job, I think, breaking down the complexity of all of that without confusing the issue in that particular case. What I thought, I was reading it and I thought, oh, shit. Okay, so it's 1876, the election. You've got angry, violent racists who are armed to the teeth. You have corrupt state governments run by these asshole conservatives. And you have a presidential election that potentially could wind up in the House. And that's what we have now heading into 2024. So the ingredients are there for something weird to happen like it did in 1876. Which is the centennial also. That also made me very sad to think about that. So,
well, hopefully we won't repeat the mistakes of the past. Hopefully we'll be able to combat this. And in a way, I write history because history is, it's not just learning about the past, but it's also a lesson in citizenship. I think Americans, with the amount of disinformation we have coming at us from these right-wing, you know, the whole Rupert Murdoch empire and other right-wing places, and of course, bad actors, foreign actors, Putin. I just read an article on the amount of disinformation that Russia is feeding into the American political system. I mean, we really are at a stage where I hope we can combat this. You know, Ted Cruz in 2020 actually tried to use the 1876 elections because these both, you know, all these Louisiana, Florida, and South Carolina sent two different slates for the Electoral College. But that didn't happen in Arizona. That didn't happen in Pennsylvania. It didn't happen in Michigan. It was one, it was quite clear that there was no other electoral state as it was during Reconstruction. But he tried to use that. And he tried to use the controversy at that time to say that maybe we should now to relook at the results. So, you know, our presidential election system, and during Reconstruction, they actually had proposals to abolish the Electoral College and make the elections of presidents direct elections, as they had done for governors of state, which in the original Constitution was indirect through the legislature, as they would do with senators in the Progressive Era. Unfortunately, that failed. And I just think we need to strengthen our democratic institutions a little bit, because you're right, bad actors could do anything under the cover of convoluted and unclear rules and pretend as if they're following the Constitution when they clearly are not. So I hope 2024 will be a complete repudiation of that kind of politics. What's shocking is the Republican Party and the way they have all fallen in line with this anti-democratic and virtually traitorous kind of agenda, where they don't want to fund the war in Ukraine, where they don't, where they praise Putin rather than our allies. And, you know, it's to me, you know, somebody said they should stop calling themselves the Republican Party, because, you know, the original Republican Party, the party of Lincoln, you know, that's not what it was, what it is today. And maybe they should just call themselves MAGA or some other nickname, because that's what they are today.
That's what they are, but they need the branding. You know, it's like they've bought the old company and they've put the sign on the door, but it's not the same people inside. You know, the restaurant's under no new management, you know.
Exactly. And there may be many Republicans who just vote for the Republican candidate.
Right.
Simply because they're Republicans and they're not going to, and they will listen to all the disinformation that muddies the waters. So it is a problem. I'm just, you know, after having written this book about the overthrow of the Second American Republic, I am still optimistic about 2024. I'm hoping that we can do this. I was one of the few people who predicted in 2022 that it will not be a drubbing for the Democrats. I feel quite proud of that. I wrote a piece on that. You know, I was like, okay, you all predicted, all these wonderful political pundits had predicted something else. And I said, no, it's going to be more like the elections of 1866, which was also midterm elections, anti-Johnson vote, where the Republicans strengthened their hold on Congress and were able to pass the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution.
I think the only way that they can cheat to win an election is if it's close. And I don't think this is going to be close. I think it's going to be a blowout. I think he's going to win by a lot. I think people are going to be surprised at how, yeah.
I hope so. And I hope the Republicans come to their senses. I mean, how many times do they have to lose before they finally realize that this is not the winning ticket, that pandering to the worst and to the sort of lowest in your base is not the way to win elections. And that's why I think they've become so anti-democratic too.
Yeah.
They have these fantasies of having a dictatorship in the United States.
Yeah, it's scary. They have no money either for the down ticket thing. The RNC is giving all their money to Trump's crappy lawyers. So it's you know.
He's going to destroy them the way he destroys his businesses.
I know. He destroys everything. Another takeaway from your book is the you know, again, the way that you weave everything together and integrate all the various things that are happening. I hadn't thought about, you know, the conquest of the West, which is really what it was. It was, you know, we just took it over. Basically, we colonized it effectively and got rid of the, you know, displaced the people that were living there. When you hear about it in the history books, you sort of are told that it was just empty space, that, hey, look at all this real estate that nobody's using. But that was not what happened at all. When I thought about U.S. empire, that was always a sort of, in my mind, the kind of McKinley into Teddy Roosevelt period, when we're after the Spanish-American War, we take Cuba, we take the Philippines, you know, Hawaii is there. I hadn't thought about the phase of empire beginning with just, you know, taking Oklahoma and pushing our way through. But that's clearly what happened. So, and you say in the book, which I thought is another interesting point, that it wasn't inevitable that happened. It didn't have to happen that way. And, you know, the slavery stuff is bad. The Jim Crow stuff is bad. This is so bad that Hitler copied it and tried to do it in Eastern Europe. So let's talk a little bit about that, because I think, you know, that idea was very interesting to me and novel to me.
Yeah, you know, somehow we've been very East-centric when it comes to U.S. history. We kind of like, okay, the West is there, as you said, like just empty land. And then the U.S. just expands, whether it's Manifest Destiny or the mission, and we just become a continental country. There might be something on the Indian Wars. As I said, they're really wars against Indians. But it's like a footnote, right? The Republic itself, first American, is founded on Indian dispossession. You're going back to the colonial era and European colonization. So people just took that as sort of an inevitable process that would happen in the West too. And there were, you know, some important and large Indian nations, like the Lakotas, like the Apaches. I mean, they had considerable political power and military power. And the U.S. had to expend a lot in terms of money and men to conquer these areas. And maybe it's because I was brought up in India with the history of British colonialism. And I looked at those wars, and they were colonial wars. They were the way in which the U.S. Army did not follow Lincoln's code of warfare, you know, of civilized warfare. The way in which they massacred women and children. I mean, you look at the massacres, you know, throughout, you know, it starts even during the Civil War with a lot of these volunteer units, especially coming from California, where they had really committed massive massacres of Native Americans. But I think at this moment, there has been so much written and done on Western history and Native American history that it is virtually historical malpractice not to look at this area while writing a history of this period. And it connected for me because a lot of times there are some of the actors are the same, like General Howard or Sheridan and Sherman. You know, I found that Sherman went to England to learn the rules of colonial warfare.
Yeah, that was good. That was a crazy tidbit. Yeah.
It was mind-blowing for me. And then I was looking at all the ways in which they wanted to, quote, assimilate Native people in terms of education, et cetera, very similar to what colonial powers would do in Asia and Africa. So I saw them through that lens. Now, as I told you, other historians have done this too, but I do it a bit differently because they argue, many of these Western historians have argued that, you know, I'm thinking of Richard White and some other very prominent and good historians who see the reconstruction of the West and the South as similar processes. And I'm like, no, no, no. The final conquest of the West comes with the downfall of Reconstruction in the South. I mean, literally the same army units that are trying to implement Reconstruction are diverted to these imperial projects in the West. So I think it's really the fall of Reconstruction that facilitates the conquest of the West. I mean, the U.S. Army would have been disbanded if there weren't these Indian wars. There was no such huge standing army. They did have a regular army force, but they were mainly deployed in the West. It grows a lot in the Civil War. And then all these men are sent out West, right? But I didn't see it as a similar political project. In the South, the nation state is doing something very different than what they're doing in the West. I don't see them as parallel processes. I see the conquest of the West as a result of the fall of Reconstruction in the South. That then those final conquests, those final wars, and these wars, of course, predate the Civil War. You could go back to the Mexican War when Western historians talk about a greater Reconstruction. They said, oh, let's go back to the Mexican War in the 1840s and 50s and see how these wars continue. But I think there is a connection here between this sort of new national mood of reaction against the idea of non-white peoples having citizenship or even sovereignty, of seeing them as incapable. You know, it's a very imperialist mindset. And it's an international mindset, because this is the time when you have the scramble for Africa amongst the European nations that feeds into the First World War. It's all these imperial rivalries between European nations. I love what a former professor of mine in Columbia, Barbara Fields, would always call the First World War. She called them the tribal wars of Europe. I thought it was very apt. But in any case, I thought it was important to look at Western history, but not try to wrap it into a simple story of you know, the expansion of the nation state. So here they have put down the Confederates and now they're putting down Indian nation. They're these alternative sovereignties. No, it's not that simple. One political project had to be replaced by another. The emancipatory aims of the nation state had to be replaced by these imperial aims. And the fall of Reconstruction, the rise of Jim Crow in the South, facilitates this. And it's in the political and intellectual atmosphere of the period. You know, you have the pseudoscience of race. This is the heyday of scientific racism, social Darwinism, the ways in which people viewed the working classes, immigrants, especially Asian Chinese immigrants, the ways in which they viewed Native Americans and then, you know, Filipinos and Cubans. You know, it's not as if these things were disparate. They were quite similar. And imperialism is one way in which we can understand the history of the conquest of the West and how it then bleeds out into the Pacific to actual colonization with the annexation of Hawaii and the colonization of the Philippines.
Yeah, you do a great job, you know, tying that all together and explaining it. And it's interesting because, like you said, there are two different, completely different purposes. I mean, in Reconstruction, when the armies are there, they're protecting, you know, they're working against racism. But imperialism in general is almost always predicated on racism. So they not only did they leave the place, they completely shifted the priority of, instead of protecting, you know, the minority groups, we're going to go kill all the minority groups now. And it, you know, it's almost like the Democratic Party, which again at that time was bad, just kind of took over and ran with it. I want to read a chapter at the end of your book, which I like that you, and I'm going to be thinking about this for a while. You call the period after Reconstruction through to the 1960s the nadir, which is interesting because that's a period of time that, you know, it's the World War II period, it's FDR, it's the New Deal, it's the 50s mostly, which is this big burgeoning period. And yet, until the 1960s, with all the expanded Voting Rights Act, it's still not really fully, a democracy. In Succession, that show, the character who's played by Skarsgård, who's Norwegian, they're talking about this at the election, and he's like, yeah, you know, your republic has basically only existed since the 1960s. So it's about only as old as Botswana's. So maybe settle down. And, you know, and he's right. So I just want to read this because this is it's the very end, but I think it's a particularly good paragraph. Even with the many successes of the Black freedom movement in the 20th and 21st centuries, the betrayal of Reconstruction haunts American democracy. The nation still lives with the competing legacies of democracy and authoritarianism bequeathed by the rise and fall of the Second American Republic. The overturning of an interracial democracy and the unrestrained triumph of capitalism and imperialism in the United States created a political thermidor that ultimately affected other groups as well, indigenous people, women, immigrants, farmers, and workers. In short, all Americans and democracy itself. Until the second reconstruction of American democracy in the 1960s, which unleashed other progressive social movements as well, the United States during the nadir was not a democracy, but a racist authoritarian state comparable to European colonies in Asia and Africa and its lingering vestige, apartheid South Africa. So I thought that was very, very interesting, the way that you categorized all that. Like I said, I'm going to be thinking about this for some time. So I wanted to roll that in there because, you know, it's just an interesting idea. There's a lot of really, really interesting ideas in the book, I think. And I'm going to be thinking about it for a while.
Well, I think I was being a little provocative there when I wrote that piece. But I think we do not, I mean, if you look especially at the South at this point, you know, it reminds me a lot of the colonies of European nations. The convict lease labor system, the debt peonage, the conditions in which people, you know, those cotton sharecroppers and tenants, black and white, reminded me a lot of the indigo farmers in India who were literally bled dry by the British. So I really wanted to get that point across. We know, we think somehow that U.S. history stands apart from the rest of the world, right? And it's more of a myth than history. I mean, as Lincoln said, fellow citizens, we cannot escape history, right? And he was talking about slavery, and I'm talking here more about the nadir, the Jim Crow era. And even though I look at the civil rights movement as completely overthrowing the sort of political system that came into place with the overthrow of Reconstruction, you can see the unraveling already with in the progressive era and the rise of the New Deal state. And I do talk about that a little bit in the chapters on the rise of industrial capitalism in the North, when increasingly unions and other reformers are talking about reining in some of these gross inequalities. The fact that you had your child labor, some people want to advocate that today, industrial accidents with no compensation, you know, all the things. So the unraveling, I think, of that nadir era probably begins earlier, but it is not completely put in place until we overthrow this revanchist, diehard, reactionary, hidebound, fundamentalist, misogynistic, racist sort of era in Southern history in particular. And I wanted to make that point because it is precisely in these regions that you again have those ideas coming up and those ideas being championed by some people. And so, you know, we have to refight some of those battles. That's the reason I want people to understand that if you go back to the nadir, you will have a second nadir, which is not so nice. And I don't think history repeats, but I do think we live with the legacies of our past. And maybe somebody who is not my student or historian will pick up this book and read it and realize that we are at another crossroads today.
We are. When you were saying that thing and describing that, that it's racist and misogynistic and all these things, what I thought is that's the great America that Trump wants to return to. When he says make America great again, that's what he means. He means that period of time, which just sucks for most people. You know, it's just terrible. So I have one more question. And you kind of alluded to this when you were speaking just then about the history and how to escape from the history. And I think in this country in particular, because everything's so new all the time and we're constantly reinventing, we are reluctant to go back and look at our past and look at mistakes we've made and own up to, you know, sins that we've committed, national sins that we've committed. So we have the two sins mostly are slavery and you know, genocide, those are two biggies. And we don't really talk. I mean, we talk about it, but the atonement isn't there yet, I don't think. And I think that's part of our problem is that, you know, we talked about at the beginning, we went right from Reconstruction into, okay, we'll pardon all these people and screw it. And then right back into it. And we never really dealt with it the way that it should have been dealt with. So my question is, how does a society, a people, a government atone for the sins like that? Or is there a way? What do you think?
You know, there is an actual attempt to sort of prevent the understanding of U.S. history today.
Yeah.
You know, they want to ban books. They don't want, you know, anything that is remotely connected to the history of slavery and racism in this country is immediately seen as, you know, making people feel bad. I'm like, why? If you're a white American and you're a decent human being, why would you identify with slaveholders? Why not identify with white abolitionists or radical Republicans or union leaders or, you know, people who fought for American democracy? Why do you have to identify with Confederates? I mean, excuse me? You know, why identify with traitors to the American Republic? So I do think it's important to read this history, but to also understand that there was always opposition to it, that it's not as if the United States is irredeemably racist, because I think that kind of pessimism also feeds into the narrative that a lot of these people want to tell, which is that they portray themselves as American patriots when they are not. You know, as Lincoln said, you know, when if these people who want to be nativists and racist, he says, I prefer going to Russia there where, you know, autocracy can be taken pure without what he called the base alloy of hypocrisy. You know, I would say just read Lincoln, you know, and maybe you'll get an idea of how bad these guys are. But in any case, you know, I think it is important for us to understand that, you know, understanding U.S. history in all its complexity and nuances doesn't mean that you can't be patriotic. I mean, dissent is the highest form of patriotism. The people who have tried to uphold the United States to its highest ideals, you know, through protest and et cetera, have done the right thing. Those who wrap themselves around the flag and then go on to desecrate every constitutional protection, every Republican idea, and I mean with a small r, every Democratic ideal that this country is founded on, I mean, they are the problem. And I think it's important for people who are fighting for American democracy not to let these guys get away with it, but to expose them as the frauds that they are. Trump is a very good example. He can keep hugging the American flag while, you know, selling our national security secrets to God knows who. You know, it's really, really important for us to understand what true patriotism is and what it means to be a good citizen of the American Republic. And, you know, I'm a bit old-fashioned that way. I think all American citizens should learn U.S. history. That it should, you know, we don't think of history as an important, you know, everyone's into STEM. My own sons are completely in the STEM fields, but they're good readers, luckily, so they read history. But it's really important for us to educate good citizens. I mean, that's what the founders, they keep talking about the founders. They have not the slightest idea of what the founders said, which was you need an educated and virtuous, politically virtuous citizenry in order to safeguard republicanism. That, you know, that's where it lies. It doesn't lie in the hands of leaders who can, you know, betray you, who can prove false to their oath of office, as clearly Trump did and former Confederates did. So, it's important for us to learn the bad stuff with the good stuff, too. And to understand that, you know, at one point you have to pick a side, not just because you're going to be partisan. I mean, I look at some Republicans who've left the party because of Trump. I mean, I completely disagree with their political policies, with everything that they stand for. But they're not a threat to American democracy the way Trump is. And they've understood that. And I admire those people. The people who are especially cowardly and who I think, you know, people like Mitch McConnell or Ted, well, even worse, you know, those Ted Cruz's and the insurrectionists themselves. I mean, they are, I mean, as Lincoln warned in his Lyceum speech famously, that if the American Republic falls, it will not be because of some external force. It'll be some external force taking advantage of our internal divisions and having somebody who will prove faithless to our principles. And I think Trump embodies that. You know, if he wasn't such a buffoon, maybe we'd take him more seriously. Take the threat he poses more seriously. But, you know, when he's running around talking about bloodbaths and being a dictator, etc., you know, he's desperate. He'll do anything for self-preservation. We know that. So, you know, just read the past and see what you can do. Use it as a roadmap for the future. So I hope people will pick up the book and read it and not think that it's just another history book, because I think it really does speak to our current moment. I certainly didn't plan it that way. But now that it is coming out at this point, I hope people will pick it up and read it.
I hope so, too, because it's, you know, like I said at the top, I really think it's, you said you wanted to write a sequel to the Eric Foner book. And I think you have. I think this is, you know, this is right up there. This is going to be, you know, hopefully something that is around for a long, long time that people are going to refer to, because I think it's an important book. I really do. And thank you for that answer. You talked before about, you know, why do these people have to identify with the Confederates? Why can't they identify with the good guys? And that's always the thing that's so interesting about the Civil War period to me, is like, there are these people that are magical. Like Lincoln, to me, if you read how he writes and the stuff he says, it's like he got beamed back to the past or something. Like, he's so ahead of the time, and he's such a good writer, and he's funny. You know, it's really something to sit down and read the stuff that he wrote. So even in the depressing times, there are these figures to look to learn and inspire. So now, where can we find you? You're still on Elon Musk's hell site with me, yeah?
Yes, you know, I went to Blue Sky and to other sites. I can't stand the kind of encouragement that Musk has given to right-wing forces in this country. And you know, a bunch of these billionaires who think that their money can buy everything and can ruin, you know, our democracy. And I'm conflicted about it because a lot of people saying you shouldn't be in the site at all. But on the other hand, I've been on some of these other sites like Blue Sky, and most of the journalists and the breaking news, and you don't find the right-wing types. Many times the right-wing trolls will come after me in like huge batches, like go back to India where you were born.
Oh, God.
They use nativism, they use misogyny, they use all kinds of really awful, horrific language at me. And I block them and I delete their replies, etc. But I was just thinking, I said, where can we have, in this site, we need people answering those people. You know, we need people exposing those people. Otherwise, it's going to be like an echo chamber, like Fox News. And, you know, Elon Musk apparently gets really angry when tweets criticizing him and, you know, portray, you know, telling the truth, unlike him, get like all these likes and get tweeted out. And sometimes when he gets fact checked on his own site, I love that.
It's funny. You know,
it's really good that he does, because I think he's a danger. He's a real threat.
Absolutely.
And, you know, he has kind of destroyed Twitter as much as he can, but many times more than the people who agree with me. You know, people say, why do you even waste time debating these people? And that someone has to answer them. And so I just answer them and block them, because they can keep going on and becoming more and more rude as things go. And I don't respond to abuse. So I'll respond to them and then block them. And that drives them insane because they can't reply to me anymore. But yeah, I'm still in the hell site a little bit. I tend to go on to other sites too. Thanks to the release of this book, I finally opened an Instagram account, which my son had to explain to me. But I've been on Facebook and Twitter for a very, very long time. Facebook mainly to connect with my friends and family all over the world. But, you know, and now that Trump has criticized it, I'm going to stay on it. I think social media has become so critical in terms of political information that we, as, you know, for whatever little clout I have, I'm going to use it for the good. And that's why I stay on Twitter. I refuse to call it X, as you may notice.
Yeah, I don't call it X either. I'm staying on too. My basic position is seed no ground. You know, I'm not giving up. I'm not giving up Twitter account. I'm not giving up this. And if the fascists come to overthrow us, I'm not leaving New York either. You know, they could, that's just it. Seed no ground. So again, your book is called The Rise and Fall of the Second American Republic, Reconstruction 1860 to 1920. By the time you're listening to this, it will be out. So go to your favorite place to buy books and buy it and read it. I cannot encourage it more enough. It's really, you know, congratulations. This is really a phenomenal achievement, I think. In my humble opinion, I think it's just, it's really fantastic book. So congratulations. Manisha Sinha, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Greg. And thank you also for those kind words. As I said, yours is the first public reaction to the book. So I really appreciate your endorsement here. So thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Serena Zabriskie, Marie Cast, and Martha Acuna provided the introduction in Ukrainian, French, and Spanish, respectively. Voice talent is by Stephanie St. John and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kanai Williams, Kimberly Johnson, and everyone else at MSW Media. If you'd like to support this program, get three friends to subscribe. The more downloads I get, the better the show does. You can also subscribe to The 5-8, the live YouTube show I do with my friend Stephanie Koff, a.k.a. LB. Tune in tonight for your Friday night hang. Most importantly, please subscribe to The Prevail Substack, with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $6 monthly or $55 yearly subscription funds my work on the column and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely, be kind to each other, try and enjoy yourself, and until next time, we shall prevail.
MSW Media.
I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela. You know what you need in your life? The Final Word Podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word Podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.